Chapter 3. I was still aroused from all the talk downstairs about sleeping in one big bed with all my wives, so I took hold of Ibsith's supple ass, lifted her as she wrapped her legs around me, and pushed her back up against the closest wall.
Oh, Eddie!
The elven woman gasped.
I burn for you. My body calls for you all the time.
I want to be inside your tight pussy. I growled. Being pregnant has only made you hotter. As the petite woman's body began to move and writhe with desire, I nuzzled my face against her velvety neck and kissed her skin. Ibsith ran her fingers through the back of my hair, but her gentle caresses were firmer this time and more urgent. Then my first wife released the grip of her legs around me, slid down the wall, and took hold of my belt buckle.
I want to taste you, my king.
Ibsith purred, and she unhooked my buckle and pulled down my pants as she got to her knees.
I wish to please you before you fill me with your manhood.
What's gotten into you? I grinned and was surprised by how turned on I was by this new side to Ibsith. The petite woman just smiled up at me, and she pulled down my boxers as my impressive erection sprang back up to attention once it was released from the confines of my clothes. Then the blue-skinned woman took hold of my shaft with her delicate hand and guided my rock-hard cock into her mouth. The sight of Ibsith's full, pouty lips wrapped around my dick as she began to bob her head up and down made me start to throb in her mouth, and I tossed back my head. Oh, fuck, I groaned. You're so fucking good at that. Jesus, Ibsith. I had to lock my knees to remain upright as the waves of pleasure washed over me. My first wife went slowly at first, but then she started to pick up speed and take me deeper into her mouth, until I could swear I felt the back of her throat. When the pressure started to build in my core, I had to put my hands on the tiny woman's shoulders and pull my hips back until my cock fell from her mouth with a wet plop. Not so fast, baby, I snorted. You need to have some fun, too. Ibsith giggled, and I got down on my knees in front of her and pulled my shirt off.
Eddie.
Ibsith sighed at the sight of my bare chest as she moved to climb onto my lap.
You're so strong and handsome.
Hold up. I chuckled before I tackled her to the ground. It's still your turn. As I unbuttoned and pulled her tight jeans off, Ibsith pulled her sweater off and revealed my favorite set of her underwear. The bra was pink and sheer, and I could clearly see her round, plum-colored nipples. The panties were a tiny thong, with little flowers embroidered where the leg straps were attached, and I pulled them down her smooth thighs, threw them in the corner of the room, and then buried my face between her legs. Ibsith keened as I licked her clit and tasted her tangy juices.
Eddie! Yes!
I grabbed the white-haired woman's thighs as I relentlessly sucked and licked, and I greedily lapped up the pearls of moisture around the tight opening of her channel. Ibsith was so wet, and that turned me on all the more. The tiny woman moaned.
Oh, God! I need you inside me!
Ibsith squirmed away, got onto her hands and knees, and wiggled her round ass playfully. I got onto my knees again and grabbed her supple hips, and then I slowly pushed myself inside my wife's narrow tunnel. Fuck! I snarled. Yes, it's like you're even tighter than before.
Take me, Eddie!
Ibsith mewled as she thrust her hips back into me.
I'm yours!
I pistoned in and out of Ibsith as she pushed harder and harder against me. It was like a wild animal had been released from inside my sweet, mild wife, and she fucked me like a minx. As I jackhammered against her ass, the soft flesh jiggled with every sweet impact. I could feel Ibsith's muscles tighten and contract as she got close to orgasm, and it was all I could do to focus and not come right then.
Yes! Oh, hard, Eddie!
Ibsith pleaded.
Oh, I'm so close! I'm going to...
The blue-skinned woman's back arched as the juices of passion squirted from her, and I slowed my pace enough to let her catch her breath. But instead of collapsing, Ibsith turned, and my throbbing cock slid out of her, and then she pushed me to the ground in a fit of girlish giggles and straddled me.
I want more,
the violet-eyed woman proclaimed.
I want you to fill me up.
Then Ibsith lowered herself onto my cock and began to rock her hips back and forth as she leaned back and her large breasts bounced up and down. Holy shit, I hissed as I slipped in and out of my curvy wife. Ugh, you feel so fucking good, baby. Ibsith exulted as she threw her head back.
Oh, you're so deep inside of me. Oh, my king.
I wrapped my hands around Ibsith's hips, and my fingertips pressed into her soft flesh as I guided her hips back and forth. All of my senses were filled with the blue-skinned woman, from her smell to the sensation of her skin against mine. You're gonna make me come, I snarled. Oh, fuck, baby. You do that so good.
I want you to come.
Ibsith panted as her inner muscles began to tighten again.
Fill my womanhood with your seed.
My cock throbbed against her cervix, and then we came together as the combined juices of our climaxes spilled from my wife's entrance. Ibsith shuddered and crashed down onto my chest. Then we just held each other for a long moment, spent and content. That's the best it's ever been. I chuckled as I tried to catch my breath.
Every time with you is better than the last.
Ibsith sighed and snuggled against me. After we'd taken a moment to enjoy the afterglow, the two of us got up and started to get dressed. Then I noticed the wet spot on the carpet. Oops, I snorted. Looks like we left a mess.
Oh!
Ibsith giggled.
Don't worry, I'll clean it up.
I'm gonna go check the shed out back, I said as I buckled my pants, and then I wrapped my arms around the petite woman and kissed her. I love you.
And I love you, my king.
Ibsith smiled at me with adoration in her purple eyes. I flashed her a wink and gave her one last smack on the ass before I headed out into the backyard to take a look at the shed David used as a man cave. As I stepped out of the back door, there was the sound of voices and work from Brock Stanton's yard, and when I looked over, I was amused to see some men in day-glow yellow shirts with the construction company's name on them. The workmen had removed most of the fence between my new yard and Brock's yard. I smiled to myself as I watched them break the cement poured around Brock's ridiculous pool. I wondered if Stanton regretted his claim that part of my property had been over his side of the property line, only to have a surveyor confirm it was his yard that had crept over into my property by several feet. Now, the work crew had to remove the cement and move Brock's fence back. Then I caught sight of the thick-necked man as he stood on his back patio with his arms folded and a sour expression on his face. Hi, Brock! I called over the sound of the cracking cement. I waved with a cheery smile on my face, and Brock just flipped me off. I'd probably have done better not to fuck with Stanton at the moment, but the type A asshole could go take a flying leap off a very short pier for all I cared. Brock was a bully and a dick, and hopefully after this he'd give up on his weird vendetta against my wives and me. Nothing the bald man tried had worked, and now he had to sit there and watch his backyard shrink because he couldn't let someone else win. Served him right. I walked past and went into the well-kept shed as I chuckled to myself. The last time I'd been in there, it was filled with Civil War miniatures, painting supplies, and a mini-fridge. Now it was a blank slate, and I could turn it into anything I wanted. I looked around at the bare, insulated walls and the heated floor. What would I do with this space? Once Whitmire's place was out of escrow, Nyla May would move in there, and I supposed Amrila would stay in the trailer until I bought another house. That meant it would be a little while until I could convert the trailer into a man cave, but this place would be a quiet retreat for me until then. I pictured a drafting table in one corner, some shelves or a big toolbox against another wall, and maybe a work table for when I clean my weapons. I could also get a gun safe, a comfy chair, and maybe a little fridge. Maybe I'd also get a couple of big dog beds and put them under the work table for Growler and Dread. Then I thought it might be good to build a heated doghouse in one of the yards for the Garms. Winter was around the corner, and it would take a while to housebreak them, so I added that to my mental list, too. I wondered if I would ever check everything off that to-do list, but I really hoped not. There was something about the list that gave me a sense of purpose. I pulled out my phone and poked around online for a drafting table, mini-fridge, and the dog beds. The work table was something I wanted to be able to look at in person, rather than order it and hope for the best, but I already knew the kind of drafting table I wanted, and I could get it within a few days. It would be nice to have a dedicated space to draw again. I still sketched from time to time, but it had been a while since I'd really sat down to draw. Once I'd ordered some of the items I wanted, I looked around the empty space again and considered what I should tick off my list next. The biggest item was easily kill Ursinger, but there were a couple of steps to that one, and a lot of them would come after the meeting with the leaders of the gloom. But I would take the crystal shards down to the dwarves so they'd have time to work up new bullets. I headed back through the new house to let the ladies know where I would be. Amrila and Nilame were in the dark-haired woman's new room and had the bed halfway reassembled. "Hey," I said as I knocked on the doorway and leaned into the room. "I'm going to go see Sagor and give him the new batch of crystals. Do either of you want to come?"
"I think I'll stay and help Ibsith and Nilame get settled,"
Amrila said as she tightened a screw on the bed frame. I suspected that choice was driven by my Zinkari wife's greedy heart. The horned woman knew as soon as the elven women were moved into the new place, she'd have the trailer all to herself. But Amrila loved Ibsith and Nilame, and I suspected she'd get bored and lonely pretty quick. I would have bet money it would be half a day before Amrila came over to the new house to hang out. "All right," I grinned at the two women. "I'll be back soon." I found Ibsith in the master bedroom as she put her clothes away in her new dresser. "Hey, baby," I said as I stepped into the room. "I'm going to see the dwarves, but I'll probably pick up some beer for them first. Do you need anything from the store?"
"No, my king,"
the elven woman said in her sweet voice, but then she thought about it for a moment.
"Actually, I have been thinking about that one fruit for 3 days. What are they called? They're small, sweet, and red, with little leafy tops."
"Strawberries?" I laughed.
"Gods, yes!"
My petite wife gasped and clapped her hands together.
"For all the love you have for me, please, bring me some strawberries."
"Of course, baby." I grinned. Then I headed out and smiled to myself as I drove to the store. My dad loved to tell stories about all the wild things my mom had craved while she was pregnant with me. To hear the old man tell it, you'd think he traveled the world to find the last jar of a particular brand of pickle in existence, or that he'd personally climbed a coconut tree to get my mom the finest coconut ever grown. As a kid, I thought they were the funnest stories, but now I understood why my dad had made such a big deal about them. There was just something about a store run to satisfy the craving of a pregnant woman that made me feel more like a husband and a father than anything else ever had. And as I pulled into the grocery store parking lot, I felt like the luckiest man alive. I grabbed a couple of cases of beer and spent a little longer than normal to pick out the best strawberries the store had to offer. And then I headed back home.
"Oh, my love!"
Ibsith squealed, and she looked at the strawberries as if they were the crown jewels.
"These are perfect."
"Not as perfect as you." I grinned as my first wife happily popped one in her mouth, and her eyes rolled back into her head with the sheer joy and ecstasy of the moment. Then I kissed her on the head and headed over to the trailer to get the basket of shards. It wasn't easy to maneuver two cases of beer and the basket strapped over one of my shoulders as I walked through the tunnels that led to the home of the lost dwarves. Not that the beer or the shards were very heavy, it was just awkward and made the walk slower than it normally would have been. But I made it without dropping or breaking anything, and once I got to the dwarves' living/working space, I found Torek and Dorim at separate tables, hard at their work. Torek was hunched over in deep concentration, as sparks flew up and swarmed the air around him. Dorim, on the other hand, had an arrangement of glass bottles on his table filled with different colored liquids. He carefully poured a cloudy, light blue liquid into a beaker of a dark yellow substance that sat over a small burner, with a tightly controlled flame. I didn't want to startle either of them, so I waited near the doorway for a moment and quickly set down the beer on an unoccupied table. I watched with keen interest as the cloudy blue liquid mixed with the thick yellow stuff that had started to bubble. And as the gray-bearded dwarf slowly mixed the two substances together, they turned a dull green and then slowly transformed into a foamy, bright turquoise color.
"Ah!"
Dorim let out a self-satisfied sigh as he leaned back and looked at his work.
"Torek, if you're done making a mess, we've company."
Dorim had on his usual gray tunic that almost faded into his beard and hair. Even the grouchy dwarf's eyes were gray. As the drab dwarf turned to look at me, those gray eyes darted over to the two cases of beer, and he hopped off his stool, walked over, and then opened one case to take out a bottle.
"Good are you to wait?"
Dorim grumbled as he helped himself to the beer.
"If I would have rushed mixing those reagents, it could have bubbled over and burned a hole right through the table."
"Eddie!"
Torek said in a hearty voice, and he walked up and also took a beer.
"Always a pleasure to see you."
"What are you gentlemen working on?" I asked curiously, since the dark-haired dwarf's face and forearms were covered in soot.
"I've been putting together a mechanism for Becklin."
Torek grunted as he took a gulp of beer.
"He's been working on a theory about how the ancients imbued metal with magical properties. The little man has dreamed up a pressure chamber he thinks would streamline the process. So I've been smelting, casting, and soldering valves for days."
Do you think it'll work? I asked, with a curl of excitement coiled in my core. Something like that would be a huge game-changer. I didn't really understand how much of the ancient dwarves' knowledge had been lost, or what all they'd been capable of at the height of their culture. But the idea that little Becklin could be on the verge of that kind of breakthrough seemed huge.
There are some gaps in his hypothesis,
Doram replied in a dark tone.
I told him to test the chamber in a far corner of the citadel. No sense in blowing all of us up if he's gotten a measurement wrong or a valve on backwards.
What's he trying to do exactly? I asked Torek, who seemed far more optimistic about Becklin's idea.
I could take you to where he and Sagor are working, and let him explain it himself.
The burly dwarf smiled.
I'm just a lowly blacksmith and engineer. I put things together and pull them apart when needed.
Well, here are some more shards from the Crystal Forest, I told Doram as I handed the gray dwarf the basket.
Excellent!
Doram smacked his lips as he took another sip of beer.
I'll start processing them while my reagent settles.
Make sure to leave some hole for Becklin,
Torek warned.
His experiment will require full pieces of crystal on gems. Powder won't do him any good.
Doram mumbled something under his breath, but Torek and I had already started to head out of the dwarves' work area and into the corridors of the old citadel. The two of us found Sagor and Becklin in a round chamber with large stone tables carved all around the walls. The smooth walls had been polished to a high sheen, and the floor had thin channels carved into it in intricate patterns. In the center of the room was what looked like a metal coffin, with pipes and gauges that ran along its sides. The design and execution of the metal box was out of this world. It wasn't some cold industrial contraption, but a work of art. Even the filigree embellishments seemed to have a purpose beyond just decoration. I couldn't read Dwarven, but every knob and lever seemed carefully labeled in neat gold letters.
Brothers!
Torek announced our presence.
Our human friend has come to see us, and he brought more beer!
Eddie Hill.
Sagor smiled at me, but his eyes looked tired.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you too. I smiled back. Torek told me you're working on something new.
It's most exciting.
Becklin piped up as he gestured to the metal device.
If I'm correct, this chamber will allow us to enchant items with powerful properties.
That's great, I replied. But how? I thought the cobaltite was all you needed to do that.
We can grind up the crystals, bind them with the cobaltite, and imbue metal with magical properties like your bullets,
Sagor explained.
We could even create weapons and armor that have some magical effects by taking the crystal cobaltite mixture and smelting it into the metal.
But with this chamber,
Becklin interjected,
we could add much more powerful magic to items without adulterating or weakening the metal with additives.
Theoretically!
Doram's gruff voice came from behind me as he entered the dome-like chamber.
Theoretically,
Becklin conceded.
But it was possible once, and I think we're well on our way to rediscovering how it is done.
That's amazing, Becklin, I said to the small red-headed dwarf. I'm sure you'll figure it out. Becklin smiled up at me, and then he shot a dirty look at Doram before he turned back to fiddle with his pressure chamber. That reminds me, I said as I looked around at all four of the dwarves. Something wild happened the last time I used those special bullets Torek made me. I was fighting this orc, and he transformed somehow into the weird, swollen version of himself. I used the magic bullets, and they didn't seem to have much effect at first. But after I'd shot him enough times, they started to glow inside of him, and then they exploded.
Exploded!
Sagor repeated as he stroked his long white beard.
Do you know what caused the transformation?
I think it was something to do with the demon lord Belzat, I replied. The orc had the demon symbol drawn on his forehead in blood. I didn't see the first part of the transformation, but what I did see happened really rapidly. He got all big, and his muscles grew until they started to crack his outer layer of skin. It was pretty gross.
It sounds gross,
Becklin squeaked.
But if the blood was that of a demon, then it might have been an alchemical reaction to some property in the bullets.
It would be hard to say which, though,
Doram added as he scratched his lower stomach.
The bullets Torek made are meant to be all-purpose in a way. They contain multiple elements.
So we'd need to know what about the demon blood had triggered the reaction.
I didn't think to get a sample, I snorted as I leaned against one of the stone tables along the walls of the room. But Nilame and I had to fire more than a dozen rounds in his stomach before they exploded.
That's interesting,
Sagor nodded.
As we told you when we first made them, the formula may not have been as stable as we would have liked.
Betlin's calculations were sound for once,
Doram interrupted with uncharacteristic generosity.
They had to have reacted to the orc's blood. Given a profound state of transformation, it might not have been orc blood anymore.
What do you mean? I asked with a furrowed brow. Like his blood transformed too?
It's possible, Sagor replied. If his transformation was part of a possession, then it might be that the bullets reacted to demon's blood.
Oh, fuck. Well, it was useful at the time, I said, as I crossed my arms and thought back to the fight with Igurg. Even though they didn't slow him down at first, I could tell the bullets hurt him. If you could figure out what element in the blood the bullets reacted to, could you make bullets that would explode when they hit? I thought about how Ursinger had the same swollen look Igurg did when I fought the Yeni chief in the woods. The idea that Ursinger was being slowly possessed had come up before, but maybe there was something about the mad chief that made the process slower than it had been for Igurg, who'd looked like something was about to rip its way through his skin. Ursinger's ego might be the difference between the two. The Yeni chief's arrogance wouldn't let him just give in to the demon lord's influence and become consumed by Belzat in the same way.
That might be possible,
Doram said without a hint of his usual terse skepticism.
If it had something to do with Belzat, then you would need to find out the nature of the demon. What is his domain? From what elements does he draw his power? If you can find that out, we can make bullets to counter it.
Fucking right! I grinned as I looked at the dour dwarf. Then that's just what I'll do.
How?
Becklin asked in his clear tenor voice. I don't know yet, I said, but I know some people who could help.
Just don't take too long, Sagor warned. The longer Belzat has to work his influence over Ursinger, the more powerful Ursinger will become.